Well, thank you for inviting me. It's my second time, I think, back in Chicago since I left DePaul University, and I always come here with probably more dread than anticipation, but the dread is alloyed on occasions like this when I get to see my former students who always bring back warm memories, so I'm glad to be here. It's struck me how it's often said that the purpose of the tenure process is to protect the speech rights of faculty, yet it's been my experience that it's always junior faculty, like Professor Perlman, who show the courage, and it's the tenured faculty who display none of it. And so I want to say to Professor Perlman, I respect the fact that she was willing to introduce me, because I know you pay a price for that in academic life. And I honor that. That's a decent gesture. I was originally intending to speak on Gandhi and the Israel-Palestine conflict. I've been, for the past several months, slowly going through the 100 volumes of his collected works. But after the events in Gaza, it seemed to me inappropriate to be lecturing Palestinians on the virtues of nonviolence. So I decide to amend the topic for this evening's or this afternoon's lecture and to speak instead on the recent events in Gaza, basically to talk about what were the motives behind the Israeli massacre in Gaza. We can, I think, straight away dismiss or discard the official account, namely Israel went into Gaza because of the rocket attacks. That account is on its face ludicrous, because if Israel wanted to prevent the rocket attacks, it wouldn't have broken the ceasefire which provoked the rocket attacks, a topic to which I'll return later. So we'll just leave that aside. There was speculation early on in the massacre, the first few days. There was speculation that the motive had to do with the upcoming Israeli elections. I didn't attach too much significance to that claim. It is true that the Israeli political parties were jockeying for votes, and killing Arabs is always a crowd pleaser in Israel. And during the massacre, the support for it was hovered around 90% among the Israeli population. But it's not really, in my view, a credible explanation of what happened, because Israeli political elites tend to be loyal to their state. And loyalty to the state means they don't undertake a major operation simply to win votes in an election. They're conscious of and sensitive to the interests of their state as they conceive it, and they would not sacrifice or squander those interests merely to win an election. So I don't think that is a credible explanation either. It's part of the explanation, but in my view, it's a secondary factor. Israeli governments have, of course, carried out attacks against foreign countries for electoral reasons. For example, in 1981, then Prime Minister Menachem Begin, he bombed the Azarak reactor in Iraq, but the Azarak reactor wasn't a strategic interest for Israel. It was contrary to widespread belief. It was not in the business of making nuclear weapons, and it was plainly just an electoral ploy by Mr. Begin. In this case, I think The fundamental motives for the war, for the massacre, was obviously not a war when the ratio is 100 to 1 killed and 1/3 are children. That's not a war. That's a massacre. And to be faithful to English usage, unless there are two sides shooting at each other, it's not a war. It's a massacre. And so henceforth, we'll use what I take to be the proper language. The fundamental reasons behind the massacre, I think, are twofold. Number one, Israel's desire to restore what it calls its deterrence capacity, a term I'll explain in a few moments. And secondly, Israel's desire to defeat the latest Palestinian peace offensive, a problem Israel has always had to confront, or at any rate confront for the last 30 years or so. So let's turn to the first motive. A few days into the war, the New York Times's main correspondent in the occupied territories in Israel, a fellow named Ethan Bronner, he said that the purpose of the war, or the larger concern of the war, was to reestablish Israeli deterrence because its enemies are less afraid of it than they once were or should be. And Israel has always been worried or concerned. A key feature of its strategic doctrine is this notion of deterrence capacity. So if you turn back to how we got to where we are today, namely the June 1967 war, in the course of which Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza, if you turn back to that June 1967 war, it too was about deterrence capacity. We're often told these fantasies that it was about this blockade that that President Nasser of Egypt had imposed on Israel, or we're told that Israel's survival was at stake during the June 1967 war. But there isn't any evidence to support these claims. The basic picture, time doesn't allow me to go through it in detail. In May of 1967, Israel announced and laid plans to attack Syria. Syria at that time was in an alliance with Egypt. Egypt, to support Syria, moved troops into the Sinai, and then in the third week in May, imposed, or what seemed to impose, a blockade on the Straits of Tehran. In fact, there was no blockade in the Straits of Tehran. Within a couple of days, Nasser was allowing vessels to pass through the straits, and anyhow, Israel barely used the Straits of Tehran. Abe Amin famously said that Israel was now being forced to breathe with one lung, that is to say, the lung at the Straits of Tehran was now being strangled, but there was no reality to that claim. The other claim that we often hear about is Israel's survival was at stake in 1967. It was one of those what Israel likes to call no-choice wars. But there's no evidence to support that claim either. In May of 1967, before Israel wanted to attack Egypt, it needed the green light from the United States. And so it kept coming to the U.S. and feeding the U.S. all the information it had, trying to prove an imminent attack from Egypt. President Johnson at the time, he gave all of the information to about a half dozen U.S. intelligence agencies, and all the intelligence agencies came back with the same conclusion. Number one, Egypt is not going to attack. And number two, if it does, in Johnson's famous words to the Israelis, according to all of our intelligence, you will whip the hell out of them. Well, that was American intelligence. What did the Israelis believe? We know exactly what they believed because on June 1st, the head of the Israeli Mossad, the main foreign intelligence agency, was in the United States, and he told the Americans, and now I'm quoting him, There are no differences between the U.S. and the Israelis on the military intelligence picture or its interpretation. That is, they agreed. Egypt is not going to attack, and if it were foolhardy enough to do so, to quote President Johnson, you will whip the hell out of them. Well, why then did Israel attack? There was this problem with this Nasser fellow. He represented this force at that time in the Arab world called radical Arab nationalism. Basically, it means the crazy idea that the Arabs should have the right to determine their future and the future or and the use of their natural resources. And in May 1967, Nasser was making all of these defiant gestures, with the emphasis on gestures because they actually had very little content, but they were arousing the Arab masses, and there was this feeling that the Arabs are getting out of line again. They needed to be cut down. These Arabs were getting too uppity, and they had to be cut down to size. The problem was they were or seemed not to be fearing Israel sufficiently. And the fear of Israel is what Israelis mean by deterrence capacity. So one of the Israeli commanders, since, you know, much better known, Ariel Sharon, at the time he said, Israel has to strike. Why? Because Israel is losing its deterrence capacity, our main weapon, the fear of us. We have to keep these Arabs fearful and thereby keep us in line. And so, as one of Israel's main strategic analysts, Ze'ev Ma'oz, wrote, the key reason for the 1967 war was to restore the credibility of Israeli deterrence, restore the fear of Israel in the Arab world. Now, if you move up to May 2000, Israel was facing another challenge to its deterrence capacity. These Arabs were getting out of hand again. They were getting very uppity. In May 2000, after an 18-year-long guerrilla war, the Hezbollah managed to expel the Israeli occupying army from South Lebanon. It was a humiliating defeat for the Israelis, one that was celebrated throughout the Arab world. And now a new war was pretty much inevitable. The Arabs had to be cut down to size. In the summer of 2006, Israel found its pretext when Hezbollah captured two Israeli soldiers. Several others were killed in a firefight. And Israel unleashed the full fury of its air force and geared up for a ground invasion of Lebanon to defeat Hezbollah. But they suffered another defeat, this one even more ignominious than the first one. There's not time now for me to go through the picture, but there, I'll quote one American military analyst, very partial to Israel, but he says this war was a disaster for Israel. The Israeli Air Force, the arm of the military that had once destroyed whole air forces in a few days, meaning the June 67 war, not only proved unable to stop Hezbollah's rocket strikes, but even to do enough damage to prevent Hezbollah's rapid recovery. And the Israeli army, also a big disaster. Once Israeli ground forces did cross into Lebanon, they failed to overtake Hezbollah strongholds, even those close to the border. As a matter of fact, Israel never even tangled with the Hezbollah crack troops, which were stationed along the Litani River, waiting for the Israeli invasion that never happened. The Israeli ground forces basically fought village militias along the border and suffered a terrible defeat. Well, now Israel's the problem with these Arabs is getting worse. A second defeat, and one again, which is greeted with euphoria, you can say, in the Arab world. And so in 2006, after the war, Israel is itching to attack Hezbollah again, but it didn't yet have a military option The Hezbollah was too strong, and Israel was not yet in fighting form. Then about mid-2008, Israel tried to conscript the United States for a war against Iran, hoping in the course of the war not only to defeat Iran, but to decapitate Hezbollah, but the United States wouldn't go along. And Israel started to threaten, or some of its quasi-emissaries, like historian Benny Morris, began to threaten that if the United States doesn't go along with a war, Israel would use nuclear weapons. But Israel was not able to get its way. Iran went its merry way, and Israel's credibility dropped yet another notch, its deterrence capacity. And now enter Gaza, Israel's favorite shooting gallery. Even there, the feebly armed Islamic movement Hamas had defied Israeli diktat, and in June of the past year, forced Israel into a ceasefire. Well, Hamas is now going to restore Israel's deterrence capacity. I should say Gaza is going to restore Israel's deterrence capacity. How was it going to do so? The Israelis were very clear about what they intended to do. There was no ambiguity, there was no illusion, and it turned out there were no surprises. During the 2006 war in Lebanon, there's an area in the South Beirut known as the Dahiya. It's a mostly Shia poor population, supportive of the Hezbollah. And Israel turned the Dahiya into a parking lot. There were six-story apartment buildings, and the whole place was leveled. I had a chance to look at it, and it looked like, you know, Europe after the terror bombing. Well, the Israelis were very excited about this, what they did to Dahiya, and they began to refer quite widely, and it was widely reported, to what they called the Dahiya strategy. Well, what was this Dahiya strategy? The IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, Northern Command Chief said, "We shall pulverize the 160 Shiite villages in Lebanon that have turned into Shiite army bases. We shall not show mercy when it comes to hitting the national infrastructure of Lebanon." And they were boasting about this Dahiya strategy, preparing for what eventually came to pass. In September 2008, after a Palestinian rocket attack, Israel's interior minister said the IDF should decide on a neighborhood in Gaza and level it. So they were going to use the Dahiya strategy. They couldn't use it against Lebanon again because they didn't have that military option. They couldn't do it against Iran, and so they sought out a defenseless population to restore their deterrence capacity. The operative plan for the Gaza bloodbath was clear as the war got underway. A reserve major general said, "What we have to do is act systematically with the aim of punishing all the organizations that are firing the rockets and mortars, comma, as well as the civilians who are enabling them to fire and hide." And the strategy was quite successful. We can't dispute it was a very impressive show. The Israeli media exulted at what they called Israel's shock and awe. And it was impressive, as I said. In the first couple of days of the Lebanon war, Israel killed about 55 civilians, but in the case of the attack on Gaza, they killed 300 Palestinians in the first couple of days. Several days into the massacre in Gaza, a quite informed Israeli strategic analyst said, quote, "The IDF, which planned to attack buildings and sites populated by hundreds of people, did not warn them in advance to leave, but intended to kill a great many of them and succeeded." The sometime Israeli historian and full-time Israeli propagandist Benny Morris, he could barely contain his pride at what he called Israel's highly efficient air assault on Hamas. But not all Israelis were as impressed. The respected Israeli columnist B. Michael, he said it's not very courageous to dispatch helicopter gunships and jet planes over a giant prison and fire at its people. Who were these people? Well, most of you remember among those killed were those at that graduation ceremony. As Gideon Levy, the Israeli Haaretz correspondent, puts it, 70 traffic cops at their graduation ceremony, young men in desperate search of a livelihood who thought they'd found it in the police and instead found death from the skies. That targeting of that graduation ceremony, incidentally, had been carefully planned for months. As Israel targeted schools, mosques, hospitals, ambulances, and UN sanctuaries, as it flattened entire neighborhoods, as it slaughtered and incinerated Gaza's defenseless civilian population, one-third of the 1,300 killed were children, Israeli commentators gloated. Gaza, I'm quoting one now, Gaza is to Lebanon as the second sitting for an exam is to the first, a second chance to get it right. And this time around, Israel hurled back Gaza, not 20 years, as it did in Lebanon, but hurled it back 60 years, into the 1940s. Electricity is available for only a few hours a day. Another gloated, there is no doubt that Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah is upset these days. There will no longer be anyone in the Arab world who can claim that Israel is weak. It's interesting to note that there's not even a pretense that the massacre had anything to do with the rocket attacks, and it had everything to do with restoring Israeli deterrence, the fear of Israel, after the defeats it suffered in Lebanon. And really, who can now claim that Israel is weak? Who can doubt that it is strong and courageous, heroic and brave? It caged in behind barbed wire fences and concrete walls a teeming refugee population, half of which is under 16 years of age. It deprived this captive population of food, medicine, and other basic necessities, reducing it to abject despair. It sprayed entire civilian neighborhoods with white phosphorus. It then proceeded to slaughter and incinerate this defenseless population, achieving a kill ratio of 100-1. Who can now claim that Israel is weak? One who is very thrilled by this performance is the New York Times' chief diplomatic correspondent, Thomas Friedman. And Friedman said, people have it all wrong. Israel did not lose in Lebanon in 2006 because Israel did what needed to be done. What did it do? He said, well, in 2006, it inflicted substantial property damage and collateral casualties on Lebanon. And by flattening Lebanon, inflicting collateral casualties, that's newspeak for killing civilians, he said Lebanon was educated. Hezbollah was educated. And now, he said, Hezbollah would think once, twice, or three times before attacking Israel again, that the terror bombing of Lebanon worked. And he said, now Israel's challenge in Gaza is to do the same. He said that Israel has to, quote, educate Hamas by inflicting a heavy death toll on Hamas militants and heavy pain on the Gaza population. In usual language, that's called terrorism, the targeting of civilians and civilian infrastructure to achieve political ends. And Mr. Friedman was thrilled that Israel had educated Lebanon and was now educating Gaza by terrorizing the civilian population and decimating the civilian infrastructure. Well, Mr. Friedman then goes on to say, but you have to understand, Israel had no choice, because these demonic, satanic, Islamic fundamentalists, they embed themselves among civilians. They nest among civilians. They're intertwined among the civilian population. What's Israel to do? Well, one problem with that claim is there's no evidence to support it. Let's look at what Human Rights Watch, which did an exhaustive study of the Lebanon War of 2006, this is what it found, and now I'm quoting verbatim. We found strong evidence that Hezbollah stored most of its rockets in bunkers and weapon storage facilities located in uninhabited fields and valleys. Then in the vast majority of cases, Hezbollah fighters left populated civilian areas as soon as the fighting started. It fired the vast majority of its rockets from pre-prepared positions outside villages. In all but a few of the cases of civilian deaths we investigated, Hezbollah fighters had not mixed with the civilian population. Okay, some of you are thinking, well, that's Human Rights Watch, liberal organization. It believes in these strange ideas like human rights. So let's look at the findings of an organization which plainly doesn't believe in human rights. There was a study done by the U.S. Army War College. It was based almost entirely on interviews with Israeli soldiers who fought in Lebanon. Now listen to these, listen to its findings. The key battlefields in the land campaign south of the Litani River were mostly devoid of civilians, and IDF participants consistently report little or no meaningful intermingling of Hezbollah fighters and non-combatants. Now, we talked about those nasty, satanic Arabs and how they use civilians as human shields, the terrible Hezbollah. But then the U.S. Army War College found, and I'm quoting, there is no systematic reporting of Hezbollah using civilians in the combat zones as shields. This is all just sheer fantasy. If Israel targeted the Lebanese civilian population and infrastructure during the 2006 war, it was not because it had no choice, but because terrorizing the civilian population was a relatively cost-free method of educating the Lebanese. And it was much to be preferred over tangling with a real foe and suffering heavy casualties. In the case of Lebanon, they educated the Lebanese. It's true. No one should doubt it. Hezbollah will think once, twice, or three times before coming to the aid of the people of Gaza. Nasrallah was pretty much limited to just giving speeches during the massacre. But they were unable, in the case of Hezbollah, in the case of Lebanon, to achieve a military victory. In the case of Gaza, it was a better picture for the Israelis. They were able to educate the Gazan population, killed about 1,300 people, did damage worth about $2 billion, destroyed about 5,000 homes, destroyed about 80% of the agricultural crops. It was an impressive education. And they were also able to achieve a military victory. But they were able to achieve the military victory because, as the Haaretz correspondent Gideon Levy put it, he said the fighting in Gaza was war deluxe. Compared with previous wars, it is child's play. Pilots bombing unimpeded as if on practice runs. tank and artillery soldiers shelling houses and civilians from their armored vehicles, combat engineering troops destroying entire streets in their ominous protected vehicles without facing serious opposition, a large, broad army is fighting against a helpless population and a weak, ragged organization that has fled the conflict zones and is barely putting up a fight. So, you know, you could speak here, I think, reasonably about a military victory, just as if a Sherman tank were to crash a schoolyard and blowtorch the children. That too, I suppose, at some level can be counted a military victory. Beyond restoring its deterrence capacity, the other main aim of Israel in the war was to beat back one of those threats that always has caused Israel great anguish, Palestinians who are becoming too moderate. That's a big problem for Israel. Israel likes to always say has nobody to negotiate with. The famous line by Abba Ibn, Palestinians have never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity for peace. Israel is always despairing. If you ever read the Israeli literature, especially the literature by the generals, every book has peace in the title. They're always looking for peace. A soldier in search of peace, an ambassador in search of peace, a general in search of peace. They're always looking for peace. And they're always despairing. And they now had a real problem on their hands because the Palestinians wanted peace. And now they don't have a pretext. The record is very clear on the general picture. For the past three decades, the international community has agreed on how to resolve the Israel-Palestine conflict. Everybody in this room knows it. It's called a two-state settlement. It means a full Israeli withdrawal from the territories it occupied in the June 1967 war and a mutual recognition between Israel and a newly formed Palestinian state and a just resolution of the refugee question based on the right of return and compensation. Pretty straightforward. And every year, the vote in the United Nations General Assembly on resolving the conflict on those terms, it's pretty much the same. It's easy for you to know. You're a computer literate generation and you use internet, so all you have to do is Google the words peaceful settlement of the question of Palestine. Peaceful settlement of the question of Palestine. And you'll get the annual resolution in the United Nations General Assembly. The vote is always the same. This past year, that resolution, the terms of which I just provided, the vote was 164-7. The whole world on one side, the United States, Israel, Australia, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Nauru, and Palau on the other side. Some of you may not have heard of some of those places like Nauru and Palau. You know, we live in a politically correct culture, so we don't want to disparage them, but we can say objectively, factually, their combined populations can fit in the empty seats in this room. That was this past year, but you could see the same record. You can choose any year arbitrarily. I'll choose the year 1989, the same terms, two-state settlement, June 67 border, and so forth. The vote was 151-3. The whole world on one side, the United States, Israel, and the island state of Dominica on the other side. Incidentally, all of the terms for the two-state settlement, apart from the refugee question, which wasn't relevant at that time, were ratified by the International Court of Justice in its July 2003 advisory opinion. It stated Israel has no right to any of the West Bank or Gaza. These are, to quote the International Court of Justice, occupied Palestinian territories. It went on to say that East Jerusalem is occupied Palestinian territory, and it went on to say that all the settlements under international law are illegal. The vote in the High Court was pretty much like in the General Assembly. The vote in the International Court of Justice, the vote was 14-1. Not very close. The reason it was not close is because these are uncontroversial questions in international law. And even the one negative vote, the one cast by Thomas Bergenthal, the American judge, he was careful to say he agreed with a large part of the majority decision, majority opinion, and he went on to say, on the question of the settlements, he agrees. There can't be any question that all of the settlements are illegal under international law. So on the crucial question, namely the one of the settlements, the vote wasn't 14-1 in the highest judicial body in the world. The vote was 15-0. Well, now you could see Israel has a real problem on its hands. The world wants to settle the conflict, and it doesn't. And it gets worse. In March 2002, the Arab League puts forth its peace proposal, the same terms. All 22 members of the Arab League, they support the proposal. And then afterwards, the Arab League kept saying, we want peace. We want peace. This is the terms. Why don't you want to settle? Well, now things are really getting awful for Israel. What's Israel to do? And now it gets really terrible because in the last several years, Hamas starts signaling it's ready for a two-state settlement. So the head of Hamas's Politburo, most of you perhaps know him by name, Khalid Mishal, in Damascus, he says, and this is one of, again, you can arbitrarily, I'm choosing one of 100 statements by him and Haniya in Gaza. He said, and I'm quote, this is from March 2008. He says, there's an opportunity to deal with this conflict in a manner different than Israel, and behind it, the U.S. is dealing with it today. There's an opportunity to achieve a Palestinian national consensus on a political program based on the 1967 borders. This is an exceptional circumstance. It includes Hamas accepting a state on the 1967 borders. There is also an Arab consensus on this demand. But, says the head of Hamas, no one is taking advantage of this opportunity. No one is moving to cooperate with this opportunity. Even this minimum that has been accepted by the Palestinians and the Arabs has been rejected by Israel and the United States. Well, now you could see there's a genuine disaster in the making. And it gets even worse, because in June 2008, Hamas enters into a ceasefire with Israel. And as the official publication in Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs website states, Hamas was, quote, careful to maintain the ceasefire. It was careful to maintain the ceasefire, although Israel reneged on the quid pro quo of the ceasefire. Namely, it reneged on its obligation to ease the blockade of Gaza. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs website goes on to state, the lull was sporadically violated by rocket and mortar shell fire carried out by rogue terrorist organizations. At the same time, the Hamas movement tried to enforce the terms of the arrangement on the other terrorist organizations and to prevent them from violating it. Well, now we have a veritable catastrophe on our hands, because Hamas is not only willing to settle the conflict, but it's showing that it's a responsible partner for peace. It engaged in an agreement. It was holding to the terms of the agreement. To quote the website again, Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire. It was maintaining the ceasefire even though Israel was not fulfilling its fundamental obligation under the ceasefire, namely to ease the blockade of Gaza. And then it gets yet worse, because according to the head of the Israeli Shin Bet, Yuval Diskin, Hamas was interested in renewing the relative calm with Israel. Well, Israel now had to act, because it could no longer justify shunning Hamas, and it would only be a matter of time before international pressure builds to negotiate with Hamas. And so Israel needed to provoke Hamas into breaking the ceasefire and then to radicalize or destroy it, thereby eliminating it as a legitimate negotiating partner. And this too is a standard operating procedure for Israel. It really is, as the New York Yankees ball player famously said it was deja vu all over again, because exactly the same happened with the PLO. Time doesn't allow me to go through the whole history, but in the late 1970s, the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, had signaled its willingness to accept a two-state settlement. And for Israel, this was a disaster, because then it has no pretext for refusing to withdraw from the occupied Palestinian territories. In July 1981, Israel entered, listen to the language, it entered into a ceasefire with Israel. At that point, the PLO was headquartered in South Lebanon, and there had been some shelling of the northern Galilee. They entered into a ceasefire. Well, Arafat was very stubborn. He stuck to the ceasefire. And then problems really began to unfold again, or I should say prior. In August 1981, the Arab League put forth a two-state settlement peace proposal. It wasn't the Abdullah peace proposal of March 2002, it was the King Fahd proposal of August 1981. It's the same problem. The Palestinians want to settle the conflict. The Arab League is on board. The Palestinians are abiding by the ceasefire. They're becoming a trusted partner for peace. So what does Israel do? The record is very clear. In September 1981, they gear up to attack Lebanon and destroy the PLO. Why? Well, here we have, you know, very candid, sound scholarship. You take the book by Avner Yaniv, he's passed away, but he taught at Tel Aviv University. He wrote a dense book called Dilemmas of Security. And he said, it was about the Lebanon War of 1982. And he said, here was the problem. He said, Arafat wanted a compromise with Israel, but Israel opposed a Palestinian state in the whole of the West Bank. So what did Israel do? It tried to sabotage the two-state settlement. How? Now I'm quoting Yaniv. It carried out punitive military raids deliberately out of proportion against Palestinian and Lebanese civilians in order to weaken PLO moderates, because that's the problem, those Palestinians who are too reasonable, strengthen the hand of Arafat's radical rivals, and guarantee the PLO's inflexibility to make sure they won't want to negotiate an end to the conflict. Well, but they had a problem. Arafat wouldn't budge. He was stubborn. He wanted a two-state settlement. He held to the ceasefire. So Yaniv said Israel has a dilemma. Either it has a historic compromise with the PLO, or it engages in preemptive military action against it. And he says Israel decides on the preemptive military action against the PLO. Why? Well, he uses a nice phrase. He says it's to beat back Arafat's peace offensive. That's the problem. Those sinister peace offensives by the Palestinians. And he says the Israeli invasion, listen to the words, had been preceded by more than a year of effective ceasefire with the PLO, exactly like Hamas in June 2008. Then Israel got desperate and it launched these massive punitive raids against the Palestinians in South Lebanon. In the last of its major pre-war attacks, it killed 200 civilians, including 60 occupants of a Palestinian children's hospital, and the PLO finally retaliated, killing a single Israeli. And now Israel found a pretext to invade. Most of you are too young to remember. It was also a very impressive show. Between June and September 1982, they killed between 18 and 20,000 Palestinians and Lebanese, overwhelmingly civilians. And as Yaniv says, they attacked not because of the PLO shelling of the Northern Galilee. There was no shelling. the PLO held to the ceasefire. He says the raison d'etre of the entire operation was destroying the PLO as a political force capable of claiming a Palestinian state on the West Bank. The problem was, how do you prevent the Palestinians from claiming a state in the whole of the West Bank? Well, you try to either destroy the organization or radicalize it so much so you can go around throwing your hands in despair and saying there's nobody to negotiate with. And that brings us to the end of the story. You fast forward to 2008. Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni says in December of this past year that although Israel wanted to create a temporary period of calm with Hamas, an extended truce, quote, harms this Israeli strategic goal, empowers Hamas, and gives the impression that Israel recognizes the movement. Translate into layperson's language, if there's an extended ceasefire with Hamas, Hamas's credibility is enhanced, and Israel's strategic goal of keeping the West Bank is undermined. Already in March 2007, Israel decided on attacking Hamas, and as the Israeli papers freely admitted, they negotiated the June truce, quote, because the Israeli army needed time to prepare. Once all the pieces were in place, Israel only lacked a pretext. And they did as they always do. On the 4th of November, as it happens this time, it was election day. The attention of the Americans was riveted on who would win the election. Israel chose that day to break the ceasefire by killing 7 Palestinian militants on a flimsy pretext, and knowing full well that its killing of those Palestinian militants would provoke a Hamas into hitting back. After Hamas predictably resumed its rocket attacks in retaliation, the words "in retaliation" are not mine. That's the Ministry of Foreign Affairs website. It says when Hamas resumed the rocket attacks, it was in retaliation for the Israeli killing of the 6 or 7 Hamas militants. And Israel now could embark on yet another murderous invasion in order to foil yet another Palestinian peace offensive, which is where we are today. It's a grim picture, and I don't think, how are we doing for time? We're up? Okay, then let's leave it at that, because I was surprised, but that's, you know, that's the how it goes. The room is only reserved for a fairly finite period of time. So I'll end now, because I want to give you a chance to comment and interrogate me. Thank you.